You're listening to Cat Tales.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Cat Tales. Singer, songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Martin Simpson is hailed as the hardest working man in folk music, and after years of relentless touring has welcomed a little breathing space imposed by recent events. Widely acknowledged as one of the world's finest guitarists, Martin is a true virtuoso and has produced an impressive catalogue of solo albums, as well as being in demand for collaborations as far-reaching as Hollywood. After 40 years, he is still producing music of astonishing power and passion, and has been honoured with multiple folk awards and has a fascination for bugs, butterflies and moths. This is The One with Martin Simpson.
It's a beautiful day though, isn't it? You have to admit it. The summers here are getting earlier and they're getting better.
Yep. Well, I'm really into bugs and wildlife and all that kind of thing. And so for my birthday, I got a moth trap, and I've been setting it every day when there's a chance to catch anything at all. But last night was utterly wonderful. It was perfect.
So tell me about these bugs then. How on earth do you catch something? Tell me. Do you catch them or do you let them go? Or what do you do with them?
I catch them first, and then I look at them and identify them, and then I let them go. And it's a very bright light, and the various different lights you can use to attract moths. There are things called a mercury vapor bulb, which basically is so bright you can't look at it. and I have a thing called a black light bulb, which is a lot gentler on the eyeballs. But last night was really, you know, when I was a kid, I used to do this. And so I'm familiar with what the weather should be like in order to make it probable that moths will come to a moth trap. And last night was warm and overcast. And it's the first time that a lot of different moths have come to the trap. And it's not, you know, by the standards of people, I follow some people on Twitter down in Suffolk, and they're going, they had 79 moths of 63 different species last night. Wow. And, you know, it's not like that. However, I did catch one of my favorite moths, which is called a puss moth. Hmm. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it has some little relatives called alder kittens, and I caught some of those too.
Oh, I love that name.
They're beautiful. I mean, moths have the most fantastic names. They really do. If you get a moth identification book, you just sit there going, wow, this is great. It's like reading a poetry book, but a very kind of avant-garde and random poetry book. It's very good. But I was wandering around on the deck after I, you know, sort of investigated these moths. And my family and I have been living in this house for 13 years. And when we moved in, my elder brother, Jeff, gave me a little tree called an alder buckthorn tree in a plant pot. And he said, you should put that in your garden because it's the food plant of the brimstone butterfly. Mm-hmm. And if you plant it, maybe you'll get the brimstone butterfly come and lay its eggs on there. So 13 years later today, in the bright sunshine, a brimstone butterfly flew into the garden. It flew around and it settled on this tree and it laid its eggs. And that's just perfect.
Oh, my word. Isn't that incredible after all that time? And, do you know, I get you. I'm fascinated. I'm just thinking of these beautiful moths. And moths are just as beautiful as butterflies, aren't they, in a different way? They're furry.
Oh, absolutely.
And they've got beautifully curly wings, some of them, haven't they? And they are... I can believe it. I can understand the fascination. I can.
Well, it is. It's totally fascinating. It's just part of what's going on. It lets you know, you know, what's happening out there and how nature's doing and that kind of thing. And if you give it a chance, that's the great thing. And that's the lovely thing about planting this tree. You know, we planted the tree, plant them and they will come. That's the plan. And so it's really nice, really nice.
So have you seen an increase in them then with all this lockdown and, you know, perhaps the better air quality and less pollution and all that? Have you actually noticed any difference?
Yes, actually I have. And I was talking to my lovely agent, Alan Behrman, the other day. He lives in Suffolk, and he's been taking walks to the edges of Minsmere Reserve down there. And he said, it's fascinating because there aren't, you know, the volume of people in these places anymore. And so he's been seeing, for instance, lots of grass snakes and slow worms on his walks. Normally, you don't see reptiles very much because they hide, you know.
Yeah.
If there's lots of people about, they just go, right, we're out of here.
Yeah.
And definitely, you can see, I mean, around where we live at the moment, there are more house sparrows than I can remember in my adult life. You know, when I was a kid, house sparrows were in every roof, and they were noisy and they were ubiquitous. And that's how they are around here at the moment, which is delightful to see because they're such sweet things, you know.
Oh, funny you should say that, because I live in North Norfolk, and the garden here over the last, I don't know, let's say 10 years, has been quite devoid of birds. And when I moved into the house, which is about 15, 16 years ago, there were quite a lot in the garden. Now, over the last few months, they've all been coming back. It's amazing. We've got chaffinches and the starlings are usually around, but they've never come in the garden like they have. And the house sparrows, blue tits, great tits. And it's a menagerie out there. Amazing difference in just that short space of time. It's lovely to behold, to be honest.
It is. It's fantastic. And it gives you hope, because nature is really a tough old bird, dare I say it, and given the chance, nature will recover, you know. We just have to stop being so stupid, really, and give it a chance, I think.
Well, hopefully this is a lesson to everybody, isn't it? And it's almost like put a stop on the world, and it's making people think and, you know, observe the butterflies and moths and the birds and maybe think a little bit more, which that can't be a bad thing, can it?
Well, if people genuinely do that, it's a very good thing, I think. So, firmly crossed.
So what else have you been doing apart from looking at the moths then? Have you been looking at creating some new music? Because all this information that's coming through there, like, you know, the new different kind of experiences, must be a great album for you.
Well, at the moment, basically what I've done, I have to give you the background, really, in a sense. Since I was 18, all I've done is constantly travel, constantly travel and do gigs, you know, drive, fly, gig, come back home, be knackered, recover, hopefully, drive, fly, do gigs. And all of a sudden, and it's an interesting situation for me, because I had a meeting at the beginning of February with my record company and my agent and my PR guy. Makes me sound like a big music industry, but I'm not, you know. It's just me attempting with the help of my wonderful wife Kit to be sensible. And we had a meeting and said, right, what I need to do is I need to come off the road, do fewer gigs, because as a musician, you know what you tend to do is you tend to take every gig that's offered, because somewhere in the back of your mind is a voice that says, well, if you don't take it now, you might never get it again.
Yeah,
and so
true.
You know, you take every gig, and then you find yourself doing, I've been doing 120 gigs a year for, I don't know, 15 years now.
Oh, wow. They don't call you the hardest working man in folk for nothing, do they?
Well, I don't know if they do call me that.
They do.
But, you know, well, a lot of gigs. And so I had decided that in order to basically make the most out of my creativity and my life, I wanted to do fewer gigs for more money, which is a very logical thing to say, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's very hard to do, in fact. But what's happened is that this thing, this awful, awful pandemic, has basically forced me into the position that I might have been too chicken to actually do, which is to say, right, I'm not going to do gigs. I'm going to stay at home. And while I'm at home, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to practice and see what happens. I'm going to play my instruments and see what happens. So one of the things that's happened is that I've gone off in some directions which I really didn't didn't expect to follow, if you like. Mm-hmm. One of them, I played the five-string banjo since I was 13. You know, I got a guitar when I was 12, got a banjo when I was 13, and I played a lot of old-timey banjo, you know, sort of what's called clawhammer, frailing banjo, and that kind of thing. And when I was a kid, very briefly, I attempted to play the banjo like Earl Scruggs, and I very rapidly discovered that basically that style of banjo playing relies on a band. It's actually part of a band. That's what that whole highly syncopated way of playing was developed in order to do. It was in order to sit there with a rhythm section which is variable but usually consists of acoustic guitar and mandolin, string bass, and the fiddle and the mandolin and the banjo take turns at playing breaks. I mean, that's in a nutshell what bluegrass is. So bluegrass banjo isn't much fun to play on your own, so I very rapidly stopped trying to do it. But in the last few months, what I've done is I've taken the accoutrements of that style. So I put on my old steel finger picks and I've started to figure out how to play the five-string banjo using some of the ideas from bluegrass, but not in any way attempting to play bluegrass music. And it's really put a rocket up my proverbial. It's just fantastic. I'm loving it. And interestingly, because I'm doing that, my guitar playing has gone off in different directions as well. So there's all that going on. Wow. I'm not attempting to write at the moment because I don't feel like it. I don't feel very much. I've started some things, but I don't feel like finishing them right now. Mm-hmm. But I'm doing a lot of arranging, and I'm doing a lot of playing. And in some cases, I'm going back to work on songs that I've known since I was a kid, which is part of the joy of being involved in the kind of music I'm involved with, you know. Yeah. When I was a kid, I saw Stephan Grossman at the Scunthorpe Folk Club. I was probably 15, I suppose. And he was this very odd character, New York Jewish guy playing blues on a fantastic sounding guitar and playing all this different, wonderful music that I already knew to some extent from the records and stuff. But to see that guy play that, and one of the particular songs that just blew me away at the time was a song that he'd learned from the Reverend Gary Davis called Delia. Delia was a gambler, gambled all around. Delia, gambling girl, she laid her money down. All the friends I ever had are gone. And I loved that song. Mm. And I learned to play it when I was probably 15 or 16, I suppose. And then when I lived in the States, I made a blues record, and I put a version of Delia on that record, absolutely, completely, differently played from the way Gary Davis had played it and the way that Stephan played it. And I've always loved the song. It's just a really moving, beautiful song. And I found myself suddenly going, oh, wait a minute, oh, here's Delia again. But in one of the open tunings that I use. And I just absolutely love it. Mm. I absolutely love what's happening with it. So there's that, you know, an old blues song that it's a ballad, really a blues ballad that I haven't played in 20 years. And then there's a song that I recorded with June Tabor in 1980 called Admiral Benbow. And I just started to play that, and again, it's, you know, it's a million miles from how I've done it before, and it's very exciting. It feels very expansive to me musically, even though I'm readdressing these traditional songs that I've known for years. It feels very expansive, and it's great. I'm loving it.
Oh, you sound like you are. It's almost like reconnecting with yourself, isn't it? And your art, because I suppose with the amount that you have been doing and all that travel that you have been doing, and it's been relentless by the sound of it, then you kind of haven't got that space, have you, to develop again and to think and to maybe just consider where you want to take things. So what you're suggesting there is maybe that's what you're now doing.
it's exactly what I'm doing. Mm. And it feels like a very strangely, it's a blessing with a very strange origin, put it that way.
Well, Martin, why don't we take a quick break and listen to some of your fabulous music, and then we can come back for some more chat. Is there anything that you would particularly like to play?
If you play something from Rooted, I tell you what, slightly odd choice, but play Hills of Shiloh.
Now, why have you chosen Hills of Shiloh?
I love what people did on it, the people that I play with. My daughter Max sings on it, and Nancy Kerr plays fiddle, and Liz Hanks plays cello. And it just really, I don't know, I just really like it as a piece of music. I could pick something a bit flasher, and I could pick something probably more commercial in inverted commas, but I just think it's a great song, and I played it on a banjola, which is an odd instrument, and I plugged it into an electric guitar amplifier, so it sounds even odder. And I like it.
Good. And what better reason is it than that? I mean, if you like it, then I'm sure everybody else will like it, Martin.
Have you seen Amanda Blaine in the hills of Shiloh, wandering through the morning rain in the hills of Shiloh? Have you seen her at her door, listening for the cannon's roar, and the man who went to war from the hills of Shiloh? Have you seen her haunted eyes in the hills of Shiloh? Have you heard her mournful cries in the hills of Shiloh? Have you seen her running down, searching through the sleeping town, in her yellowed wedding gown, in the hills of Shiloh? Seen her standing there in the hills of Shiloh, the wind blowing in her hair in the hills of Shiloh, listening for the sound of guns, listening for the rolling drums, and the man who never comes to the hills Amanda sing in the hills of Shiloh, whisper to her wedding ring in the hills of Shiloh. Heard her humming soft and low. Poor Amanda does not know it was ended 40 years ago in the hills of Shiloh. It was ended 40 years ago in the hills of Shiloh.
I'm Martin Simpson, and you're listening to Cat Tales.
Having looked at your career here, I mean, you have been around for a considerable amount of years, let's say that, Martin. You're not an old man, so you've got a considerable amount of years to still come. But, you know, in that time, you've won, you've been nominated for something like, I don't know, 20, 28, 29 folk awards, and you've walked off with, like,
I hate to say
9 or 10.
I think 32.
Oh my God! Yeah. Look, I haven't counted up right. My God, my mouth has even gone. That's how spongy my head's got. That is incredible, isn't it? 32 Folk Award nominations. I mean, how does that feel to be at the top of your game?
Well, it's lovely. You know, it's very nice indeed. I mean, the thing about Folk Awards is that you know, it is kind of it's an industry thing, but it's a thing of your peers too, and it's been great. The Folk Awards situation has been great. I really think in the next few years, the there are going to be a lot of changes and a lot of losses, which are going to result from what's happening right now. I don't feel entirely positive about that going forward, you know. Who knows what will happen with things like, you know, with the BBC is going to, the BBC's under attack. It's going to have to massively cut back because of the government's attitude to it, none of which is good. So I think we have to be very careful about how we treat our media, really.
Yeah.
Because I think there are a lot of things that really, really need to be fixed. And, you know, somebody was saying the other day, you know, about talking to me about Spotify and saying, well, yeah, it's great. And I said, no, it's not great. It's completely and utterly, it's theft as far as I'm concerned. You've got an organization which plays your music in order to make money for itself and pays you nothing, you know. I mean, there was a classical violinist saying that I can't even remember how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of hits she'd had. And she got £12, you know. And meanwhile, Spotify's, you know, made a profit of something like $680 million. So who's paying for that? You know, we are, and it's not right. So, the industry really needs to fix itself, I think, in order to survive, and in order for it to survive in a healthy way, which is from the ground up, really.
You're absolutely right. And I think what this time has actually done is put a stop on everybody doing live gigs and concerts and stuff, which means that actually that's cut off the main source of musicians' income now, hasn't it? And the download market, you know, the sale of merchandise is so small in comparison to the live industry now. There's an imbalance, and when something like this happens, it's almost like, well, there's no industry anymore for the music musicians, is there?
It's interesting how just to what an extent it's pointed out. You know, these considerable wrongs, I think.
Yeah. not good, is it? But how do you now solve that? I mean, I think looking back, you know, we were looking, well, first of all, vinyl, obviously, then CD was the answer, wasn't it? The indestructible CD, and then you had the downloads. It's almost like, you know, from there you've gone live. Perhaps we've got to go back again to actually something that says that a product that you're producing has got value. And, you know, I just hope that out of all this comes a strong music industry for everybody to, well, to prosper, really.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, I think, you know, the change between, you know, what it was like, well, for instance, you know, in 1970, say, you know, when I was but a youth, but I was absolutely on fire with inspiration because of the music that I was buying on record. You know, you get a Joni Mitchell record, you know, and you put it on and you listen to the whole thing a side at a time, and then you put it on again and you listen to it programmed the way Joni Mitchell wanted you to hear it, and it changed your life, you know.
Yeah.
And the difference between that and the disposable nature, the very passing nature of a download, you know, or, well, I'm just going to listen to it on my phone. Why? It sounds like shit.
Yeah.
You know, why would you listen to it on your phone if you don't have to, you know?
Yeah.
So I think the music business has devalued the very thing on which it thrives, and that's, you know, that's dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, there was that experience, wasn't there, of sitting with your vinyl and reading the cover from cover to cover. Sometimes you had lyrics in there, sometimes you had stories in there, and, you know, sometimes it's just a picture that you're looking at. But it was the whole all-encompassing experience, wasn't it? And you know, people are missing
Absolutely.
Out on that now. The poor youth of today, you know, I pity them.
Yeah, well, yeah. I really love the whole production of a record, you know, making a record that feels more than just a thing that you put on and it's transitory and it, you know, it's gone. I love writing the notes for my records. I love writing about the song, you know, giving the backstories, and because I know that people who care really get a lot out of that. You know, they read those notes and they go off and they explore further and they find the records that I learned the songs from. Mm. You know, and the whole thing is, it's just ongoing. It's just, it generates growth, and it's lovely, I think.
Yeah, and it's an inspiration, isn't it? And I mean, is that one of the reasons that you started to do like your guitar lessons and your workshops, to sort of like inspire and to impart that knowledge so that there's another generation coming up?
Well, I have to be brutally honest. When I was a kid, and I decided at a very young age that I wanted to be a professional guitar player. That's all I wanted to do. And I looked around, and you couldn't just start doing gigs. You know, you had to build a career from the ground up through the folk clubs, through doing floor spots and stuff. And I said to myself, well, you know, I really want to do this. I know this is what I want to do. So how can I make money doing what I want to do, which is play the guitar? And it just shouted at me. It said, teach the guitar. So I started teaching the guitar when I was 17. I wasn't highly qualified at that point, apart from I was filled with enthusiasm, but I could show people things, you know. And I very rapidly learned from teaching that illustrating what I did for somebody else, explaining what I did for somebody else, made me understand it better. And so I ended up knowing way more about what I was doing because of teaching a few people. And when I moved to the States, it was interesting. In England at the time, in the 70s and early 80s in England, teaching the guitar, if you were a professional folk musician, or actually a professional musician, it was regarded as something a bit non-you, you know, something that you didn't, well, why would you teach? You're an artiste, darling, or you're a rock and roll star, or whatever you are, you know, but it wasn't done. When I moved to the States, I suddenly realized that there was this huge thing in America of the guitar workshops, the National Guitar Summer Workshop and all these things. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I can do this. And in terms of my career, it was brilliant because I played the guitar in a way that people in America, generally speaking, didn't play because of my different background, you know.
Yeah.
And I got employed by these guitar workshops to show these people what I was doing. And immediately my profile just went through the roof over there, you know. Whereas if I just said, oh, no, darling, I'm an artist. I do gigs. I drive from town to town. I'm a troubadour. You know, I would have got probably a quarter of the exposure that I did from doing something which I think is really expansive and really sensible. So it's, you know, I love it. I love that thing.
Yeah, wonderful.
And it wasn't initially. It wasn't altruistic, you know. It became a very important part of what I do, but it was not through altruism that I got there.
Well, that's great, though. And also, you know, you are, let's say, an aficionado of guitar. I mean, crikey, worldwide they look at your guitar playing with awe. So actually to have some, you know, imparting of that knowledge and how you do that to a youth who's, you know, looking at how they could potentially be as good as you, oh, how wonderful is that, to think that you may have been the inspiration for the next Jimi Hendrix or something.
Well, I doubt that it would have been Jimi Hendrix.
No, me too, actually. the next Martin Simpson, I think.
Oh, well, good luck. Good luck with that.
Yeah, it's a tough world, isn't it? It is tough. So if you had to look back on your career so far, is there any highlights that you think, oh, do you know what, that was a defining moment for me, or do you know, I wish I could go and relive that moment again, whether it be, you know, Cambridge Folk Festival or just a folk club down the road? What would you look back on and think, lovely?
I could talk for days about that. There's so many defining moments. I mean, I was incredibly lucky to get into the music at the time that I did. You know, I mean, I got my guitar in 1965, at which point the folk scene in England was burgeoning. I mean, it was absolutely on fire from inside and out. You know, it had so much inspiration going on from the States, and it was such a Catholic scene at the time. It was perfection, you know. Round the corner, 400 yards from my house, it was where the Scunthorpe Folk Club started, and everybody who played on the folk scene played at that club. You know, I saw everybody, Shirley Collins and Tim Hart and Maddie Pryor and Carthy and Finbar Fury and Stefan Grossman and on and on and on, you know, Nick Jones and Dick Gochen and blah, blah, through the early 70s, you know. It was my university, you know. It's where I learned so much from going to that club. So that in itself was astonishing. And by, you know, by the middle 70s, when I, you know, I'd been playing since I was 12, and 10 years later, you know, Barbara Dixon saw me play at the Scunthorpe Folk Club and recommended that I make a record, and told Bill Leader that he should record me. So I made my first record in 1976, you know, and the next thing that happened was Steely Span's manager, Tony Secunda, decided he was going to make me a rock and roll star, and he put me on the road with Steely in 1976.
Terrific.
Which was actually the height of their commercial success. So I went from playing the, you know, the dog and trumpet to playing the Hammersmith Odeon for two nights and, you know, 26 gigs in with these massive successful rock and rollers, you know, folk and rollers.
Yeah.
And you know, 10 years after that, I was living in the States and working with, getting to know Jackson Browne and Steve Miller and playing with old classic blues guys who had worked with Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters and things like that. And when I look back at it, and I don't want to go back and do any of it again. Mm. I really don't. But it has been just extraordinary. You know, the musical experiences I've had, the people I've got to play with, the people I've learned from. You know, living in New Orleans for 4 years, which was, you know, like living at the circus, really. It was insane. But I certainly wouldn't be who I am without that, you know, musically or personally, really.
Wow, what a soup of talent that you've been exposed to there. Just in a few of those names are awesomely, they're legendary, aren't they? And to think that you've played amongst all those or been influenced by them alongside, I mean, that's astonishing, isn't it? I mean, what more could you ask for? Tell me, what more could you ask for?
I don't know. Just a very, very funny memory. There's a gig in Santa Monica in California called McCabe's Music Shop. And basically, it's a very cool music shop, but they built it so they can roll all the stock. It's all on screens on wheels, and they can roll it all away and turn it into a venue. And it's a legendary Southern California venue. And to play there was, you know, it's great. You know, you knew that Ry Cooder had played there, and Doc Watson, and everybody and their dog had played at McCabe's. And I played there, and I looked, and Jackson Browne was sitting in the front row, and I kind of thought I'd died and gone to heaven, really, because I'd been listening to him since I was, you know, 14 or 15, I suppose. And after the gig, I was talking to Jackson's partner, Deanna, and she said, I want to tell you something. She said, I just think it's really funny. Jackson and I sometimes sit up in bed and, you know, I'll be reading and he'll be watching your teaching video.
Oh, how wonderful.
I thought, I have died. In fact, I have died and I have officially gone to heaven.
So. Isn't that incredible? That is wonderful. Oh, Martin, that's absolutely wonderful, isn't it? To think that, you know, people are looking at you, even those that you do not expect. You know?
Yeah.
You are an inspiration.
Slightly scary.
Well, no, you just keep doing what you're doing, Martin. It's obviously working, isn't it? Where did it
Seems
all go
be.
Right? It's the question.
I think it's just basically bullheadedness, really. I believe that this is what I should be doing, and I should be doing it to the best of my ability. So, the harder I work, the luckier I get. So there you go.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly it, isn't it? Well, do you know what? It's been a pleasure speaking, Martin. I could sit here all day, but I'm sure that you've got more important things to do than talk to me. It's been fascinating and absolute delight.
Thank you. I doubt that I have anything more important to do, but I do have. I'm building a performance space in my music room at the moment, because I'm going to be doing a live gig from home. Mm-hmm. And I have to figure out how to do it.
Oh, quite.
And normally this room that I'm in, it's just a workroom. You know, it's full of instruments and it's full of bits of gear and stuff, and now I have to make it so that there's actually a performance space which looks okay on a camera, and I have to make things, technical things, work, which is not my strong point. So so that's what I'm going to be doing next. I'm going to be wailing away at building this thing.
But
it's a total pleasure to get the time to just chat and talk about things like this.
It's been absolutely wonderful and such a delight speaking and listening to your life story. It's been incredible. And there's so much more I could talk about. So we'll have to do this again.
I would utterly love to. Absolutely love to, yeah. Brilliant. Okay, thanks very much, Kat. It's a total pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, no, total pleasure for me. Thank you very much, Martin. You've been a star. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cattails.
To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattails.co.uk.